Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today's Thursday, July 14th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, precious metals with Franklin Sanders. Lots been going on in the precious metals market, so there's a lot to talk about. We've got a huge number of questions, and I hope to get to as many of them as I can. Our theme tonight is, believe it or not, from 1 Corinthians, and it's called Seeking That Which Abideth. There's a very famous passage in 1 Corinthians. It says, "And now abideth faith, hope, love, these three, but the greatest of these is love." And T.D. Jakes has a sermon that I've listened to maybe 100 times. I'm probably going to keep listening to it for the rest of my life. And he quotes Corinthians, and then he said, "The one word I want to get into your spirit is the word abideth, abideth, that which stays." And what we're watching is an infrastructure of government contracts and government contingent liabilities and government money, which for many, many decades in the United States has created an infrastructure, if you will, a social safety net, and it's starting to erode and drop away. And the challenge is that what you can count on in a world full of government money that continues is very different than what you can count on in a world where government money is dropping away. And we're about to get a lesson in what in our lives really abideth. And there's a great country and western song from a guy named Tracy Lawrence, and it's called "You Find Out Who Your Friends Are," and the chorus says, "This ain't where the road comes to an end. This ain't where the bandwagon stops. This is just one of those times when a lot of folks jump off. You find out who your friends are." And as we watch what's going to unfold in Congress over the next 3 to 6 months, and for the next couple years, we're going to watch a lot of governmental arrangements changing, and a lot more in society is going to come back and underscore the importance of family and community wealth. And that's why if you come to the Soleri site, you see family wealth, family wealth, family wealth. Because, in fact, what we're going to find is that it's certain kinds of private people and institutions who will honor their commitments and abideth. And there are a lot of large institutions and other people who might not. And it's very important to know which is which. In financial terms, the way we used to say this on Wall Street, which is the spreads are going to widen. So what's an honorable institution and what's not is going to change and could change radically. It's interesting to watch what's happening with the debt limit. You're seeing a hot potato pass around among the politicians because nobody wants to turn around and say to a variety of different constituencies groups, something's going to have to give, something's going to change. Before I start on money and markets, I also wanted to announce a big announcement. We just sent out the press release today. We'll send the press release out on the Business Wire next week, and that is I've been out in California and Silicon Valley working on our new investment advisory partnership. Soleri Advisors is a 50% partner in a new company, C-Lane Advisors. We've been operating since April, but we've just launched our website, and I encourage you to check it out. It's at SEALANE advisory.com, SEALANEadvisory.com. About 50% of our target model portfolio called Tradewinds is in precious metals. And it's interesting, it's always interesting to talk to Franklin in the Precious Metals Report because day to day through C-Lane, I'm very focused on the paper market side of precious metals. Through Soleri Advisors, I have both securities and physical precious metals, and then of course Franklin is focused on the physical market. So we seem in our day-to-day flows to have a nice complement. I'm always glad to hear what things look like just from the pure physical part of the market. And luckily we both continue to stay away from the futures and derivatives market. So I'll leave those to somebody else, but we're happy to stay out. Money and markets. The debt limit squabble is consuming the headlines. It's even pushing the issue on unemployment and jobs to the side. And I want to focus tonight in money and markets on the debt limit squabble and make sure you have an understanding of what some of the issues are. Big headline on the debt limit squabble most recently today, S&P indicated that sometime in the next 3 months, 90 days, not just because of the debt limit arrangements, but because of the question of how you cut a fiscal 2012 budget that makes sense, they may be looking to drop both the long-term and short-term ratings, and they have them on credit watch, which does have a negative meaning in the market. Now, you kind of look at this, and Moody's recently said pretty much as much, and when you look at S&P and Moody's, these are the people who kept silent throughout the whole housing bubble when it was patently obvious what was going on, and so there's some politics to whether or not Moody's are saying what they're saying, and I think the game of chicken that we talked about last week is just ratcheting up another couple of notches. Edward Albee is a wonderful playwright and once wrote in the Zoo story, he said, sometimes you have to go a long way out of your way to come back the short way correctly. And I want to underscore that what we're watching in the debate about fixing the debt limit or increasing the debt limit in Congress is simply facing the consequences of the decision we made in 1995 as a result of the last really big debt limit squabble. Essentially what happened when the Clinton administration in Congress could not reach a resolution, and that was right after the Republican Revolution with Newt Gingrich, et cetera. It got extremely ugly. We had a 2-week plus shutdown, or a pretty long shutdown. And essentially that was part of the decision and excuse to basically let's move all the money out of the country, the feeling being it is impossible in the system to reach a financially sound consensus, and so we just give up. We're just going to pull all the money out, and then once the money's gone, we'll face the music. Well, of course, now we're at face the music time, and the question is, who has any reason politically to want to turn to the appropriate constituencies and help them face the music? If anything, everybody in Congress has been taught they'll be shot. Now, we see Congressman Kucinich putting out a note today saying, this is absurd that we have to cut Social Security. If you look at the trust fund, we have plenty of money that can last until 2037. Well, what is this all about? So let's go back and revisit what the trust fund is. I pointed somebody this week to the Wikipedia entry on Social Security Trust Fund, which is pretty good. Essentially, the trust fund is separate, or supposed to be separate, from the federal budget. We all pay our money into Social Security. It's like a think of an endowment or a pension system. We pay the money in, and then the money is supposed to be invested and earn interest and then pay us back. It's supposed to be our money, right? We paid the money in. This is, be very careful when politicians start talking about Social Security as an entitlement. It's not an entitlement. It's a trust fund, and we put money in. If you look at where that money has been invested, what it's been doing is it's been financing the federal budget. So we put our cash in, and the Social Security Trust Fund buys essentially treasuries, and the money goes to finance the government. And essentially what it's done is it's gone to finance living beyond our means and a huge amount of money disappearing through the back door, like $4 trillion just going missing, and frankly payola to a lot of people to buy political support and buy elections, all on a basis that does not optimize any kind of prudent financial management or governance, no matter which way you want to cut it or who you want to blame for it. You know, it has financed a financial mess. Now, the reality is that the Treasury owes the Social Security Trust Fund that cash. Now, what's new? What's new is not that the Social Security Trust Fund is bankrupt. It's not bankrupt whatsoever. It's full of money. The problem is it's now turning cash flow negative because the people who put the money in want the money back. You know, they're aging, they're retiring, unemployment rates are high, and as of July are starting to tick up again. And so it's either going or about to go cash flow negative, which means we now need the cash back. Now, the problem is, where are you going to get that cash? And if you could create that cash with QE3 or printing money, then some politician is going to rather send that cash to somebody who will give him a donation and vote for him than just pay back the money that's been borrowed out of the Social Security Trust Fund. So you really think of the Social Security Trust Fund as the banker to the government, and the banker is now calling their note and saying they want the money back, and the government is saying, well, we don't want to give the money back. Now, what does this all mean? One subscriber wrote to me this week, and he says, you know, the money's been stolen. Well, you know, not stolen, but as a legal matter, but essentially it's gone. And the people it's gone to, whether it's you or me or a defense contractor or paying the military, it went down the black budget, you know, they don't want to give it back. And that begs the question, where are you going to finance it? And it's one of the reasons I'm so concerned about 401ks and IRAs and pensions, because if you look at 401ks and IRAs and pensions, there's $14 trillion hanging around there or more, and it's a logical place to go to finance this, because the people who have that money are the ones who want their Social Security check. So why not make them finance their own demand, so to speak? So the mechanics of this really go to the heart of how you're going to keep financing the Treasury and who's going to get the benefits of expanded monetary inflation. Now, Obama stood up recently, and this is all part of the sort of politicking between him and Congress over fashioning a new way of dealing with the growing deficits. And he said, well, you know, if we don't reach a deal, we may not be able to pay Social Security. Now, because Social Security is a trust fund and not subject to the debt limit, the only way that could happen is if the Treasury defaulted on its interest payments to Social Security, which is a government default. So it's kind of a backdoor way of saying it's a government default, but one that would scare Social Security beneficiaries. Now, today is July 14th. Congress does not recess until August 5th. Geithner said, you know, he can take it till the first week of August. I'm sure if he says that, he can take it further. It depends on whether you reach into the ESF fund or some of the other funds or backdoor mechanisms they have. Now, yesterday, what happened? The Bohemian Grove convened outside of San Francisco, up north of San Francisco. And as I've said before, I think that's where the big decisions are going to make. If they arrived yesterday and they don't all arrive at once, they trickle in, look for decisions to be made by the soonest next Monday or the following Monday. And that gives you, say, from the 21st to the 5th for Congress to implement and then recess. And again, I think the likely scenario is we're going to see a real wake-up call to Main Street. I think the decisions are going to be to really stick it to Main Street hard, and then to do a QE3. We've seen the central bank and Bernanke flip-flop, giving different signals to the market, first indicating a QE3 was possible, then sort of dampening it down. So, nobody wants to give that away. If and when they do an overt as opposed to a covert QE3, they want to make sure that they don't do it until they've bought enough political support and constituency to make it worth their while. So they're going to make people dance up and jump up and down and beg for that money. Part of the politics is we see Wall Street slashing and cutting a lot of jobs, a lot of noise coming out of the banks as they deal with the sovereign debt problems in Europe and around the world, sort of grumbling about how unpleasant this is. What specifically could we see in the next 3 weeks? One of the things they're trying to do is cut the cost of living increases on Social Security, and this is all part of the slow burn. So if you are retired and dependent in part or in whole on Social Security, you're watching your deposits, your bank account deposits, your CDs go down in value as interest rates are really at a negative return. So, you know, if the rate of inflation is, as shadow stats says, 6 to 11%, and you're getting 0.5% in your deposits, then your money's being debased 5-10% a year. So you're losing money, and the ultimate insult is you're getting to pay taxes on the 0.5% you get. And then your Social Security is right now, your COLA is about 3.5. But if that starts dropping when inflation rates are 6.5 to 11%, then you see what the squeeze has done, because your assets are being debased at the same time that your expenses are rising much faster than your income, and that's the slow burn. And this next deal is really, I think, going to be pretty ugly, particularly as we watch what happens with the combination of interest rates, expenses, and the cost of living increase. Because if I'm right that QE3 comes, then, of course, that's just going to drive expenses up for many, many fixed-income families living on a fixed income. Now, what are the big problems the guys in Washington have? They have two very big problems. One is legal nicety. It's very important to make it look like they're maintaining the appearance of the rule or to maintain the rule of law. The appearance of the rule of law is very important. And there are ways you can really stick it to Main Street, which are such an abrogation of the law that they're just not going to stand up in court. So trying to engineer this in a way that is lawful is going to be tricky. The second thing is, who's going to take the political fall? Because you have to say no to the creditors, or you have to say no to Main Street, or you have to say no to the military, or you have to say no to a combination of all of them. And nobody's figured out a way coming into an election year that can be good for their career. But we should see a resolution by August 5th. I think the chances of not coming up with a debt limit by that time, or debt limit deal by that time, are pretty small. There was an interesting article today from AP, Why Wall Street Doesn't Seem Worried About Default, and talked about why Wall Street and the markets continually shrugged the fear of a inability of the U.S. government to make a debt limit deal and then default on the debt, including the rating agencies cutting. And we had a hedge fund manager who I'll vote as hero of the week. His name is Ave Timkin. It's T-I-O-M-K-I-N. Never heard of him before, but he's got a great quote. He says, "It's very nice that Switzerland is a safe place," says Avi, a hedge fund consultant who holds Treasury, "but if you're the Russian or Chinese central bank, it's just too small." Well, going forward, here's what we watch. Watch for a QE3, covert or overt. Watch for what happens, what the signals are coming out of the Grove sometime next week. Watch the price of gold. Watch the price of housing. Can it maintain its nominal price in key global markets around the world? Watch the stock indices. And most important of all, watch the U.S. dollar index. Very interesting. Earlier this week, I had dinner in San Francisco with a group of some of the smartest financial people I know, and we took a dollar bet on what the U.S. dollar index was going to be at the end of the year, and literally the group went from, the spread was from 50 to 72, and so some of us thought it was going to be quite near where it is today, and others thought we were going to see a very significant drop in the dollar. Two very, very different strategies. So we'll see what we see, but the big news for the next 2 weeks will be the resolution of this, and it will have a very dramatic impact, not just in North America, but as it translates into a budget deal for fiscal 2012. You're going to see the rippling around the world of the results of what happens politically. So with that, we have tremendous number of questions, but I'm going to integrate them into our precious metals market report. And Franklin, I'm in California, and Franklin had to travel over to Knoxville, so he's coming in by phone from Knoxville with us. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
And you're in Knoxville?
Yes, I'm in Knoxville. I was listening to what you said, but I think that you missed the key example. When you were explaining what the government had done with the Social Security Trust Fund, that is that they bought U.S. bonds with it, in effect, financed the deficit. I really think that there's a movie that gave us an example of what the government has done, and that was, do you remember the movie Dumb and Dumber?
No, I never saw that one.
Well, in Dumb and Dumber, there are these two fellows who are dumb as a post, and they find a briefcase with $1 million in it. And when it comes time to give $1 million to the person, the briefcase to the person it belongs to, they open it up and it's filled with IOUs because Harry and Lloyd have been living out of it And they say, oh, it's not a problem. It's okay. See, we put in an IOU for every penny we took out.
Yeah, that's it.
So that's exactly what the federal government's doing. See, it's okay. We put bonds in there for everything we took out.
Well, you see, this is what I think is hard to understand is this is double trouble because they've been looking, if every year the Social Security trust fund gives you the cash you need to finance the deficit, then the problem this year is not that somebody wants the cash back. You know, it's not just that they want a dollar back. It's that they're not giving you a dollar. So there's a $2 problem. It's not a $1 problem. You need the dollar to keep financing the game. And meantime, they want a dollar back, so now you've got a $2 problem, not a $1 problem.
Right, and that turn came in September of last year, if I'm not mistaken. That is, they began taking out more than they were taking in. So that, you know, it's just it's a time bomb. Eventually, their ability to pay out benefits will be so low that they're going to have to raise the money somewhere else. But,
well, and there's something else, and this is what I saw when I built the Community Wizard tool and looked at, you know, what we did is we took the federal budget and we instead put it in databases so we could look at it county by county. And what I discovered was you had an entire society who had organized themselves and built up their businesses and their skills and their attitudes to do whatever got them government money as opposed to do whatever was economically productive. So you had trained an entire society to behave and relate to each other in ways that had nothing to do with fundamental economic productivity. And so the problem, this was not just an economic change, this was an enormous cultural change because all of the different behaviors and arrangements had organized around making government money as opposed to making sense.
Right.
And it was like this whole, you know, and it's funny, I mentioned this last week, we got somebody asking a question that said, you know, I think the problem was in Russia, you know, that they became socialists, but here they're trying to destroy the economy. And there was not an understanding that, in fact, our economy is as much socialist, if not more, as the Russian was when the wall came down.
Well, it is. Just socialist in a different way, you know, but it is. The control is the same. I was talking to someone not long ago, and he made the remark to me that probably there's more economic freedom, and this was a person who traveled to China, said probably there's more economic freedom in China than there is in the United States, considerably more.
Yes,
so this is Americans are taught to wave the flag and say, this is still the greatest country on earth, this is still the freest country on earth, and they repeat that as a mantra, and they don't notice the man standing outside their door telling them what to do.
Well, although I haven't heard anybody in more than a decade say, you know, it's a free country. You notice how that whole expression went out of the...
of the language, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I have so many questions for you, Franklin, but why don't we just first do a check-in? Because the market has been quite interesting this week, and I would love to get your take on what's been going on over the last week.
Well, you know, we were in a trading range with silver and gold, and it really was logical to expect, technically, that they would probably go down and make slightly lower lows than they had already. And so I was waiting for that, and then came the European financial crisis. And you have to realize that those crises, they just are not subject to technical analysis. I remember in 2008, events unfolded in much the same way. You had a peak earlier in the year in March, and then by July, it was about time for silver and gold to bottom. It looked like they had. They rose slightly into August, and then the bottom fell out of everything, gold, silver, dollar stocks, everything in the fall of 2008. And it was a financial panic. And in that case, all bets are off. And so what happened this week was that the financial panic drove gold above the 1560 mark. And once it got above the 1560 mark, which was the top of the range, then what happened was it just burst up to 1575, and then it burst up again. Now, the question is, where are we? Is this just a temporary move that was occasioned by that financial crisis, and will it come back down, or is this the beginning of a new leg up in gold and silver? And there's a technical rule that a breakout has to be at least 2% over the level that it's, the boundary that it's breaking out over. And this, right where we are, 1587, is right on the line of that that 2% breakout. Some say 3%, that would take us to 1603. But frankly, it looks like to me, I'm just about ready to throw the towel in. In fact, I am ready to throw the towel in on it and say it's going to go on up. If the financial crisis in Europe is solved quickly, if they come up with some kind of fix, now it won't be solved, but let's say if they can find some kind of Band-Aid to put on it to stop the immediate panic, then, you know, gold and silver will go back down. But that's really what we're that's really what we're looking at. Now, usually in a financial panic, silver does not go with gold. And so what happened was silver went down the first day and then came roaring back for a 7.1% gain, the biggest one-day gain since March of 2009, an insane gain, $2.50-something cents. That is just absolutely insane. That is a panic-driven short covering move. You just don't see moves like that. So it took silver all the way up to the top of its range at 38.50 and closed today at 38.68, I think, or 38.68. So is that a breakout? Boy, if it's not, it sure does looks like it intends to. And so you're off to the races again. Silver, even if this is a short lived thing, silver will go up to $40, $41. You know, I've thought very much about this because I've been trying to pick my way through and pick the way through for other people. And I think that the danger of missing a market like this is greater than the danger of buying and finding that the market drops out from under you, if you follow what I'm saying. In other words, okay, so you buy, it goes down 8% or 10%. It's not the end of the world, because you're in a primary market and it's going to take you back up. But I've just messed around too much with this, you know, trying to find the bottom, trying to logic it out, and then the market throws something like a worldwide financial panic at you. The reason we're buying gold and silver is to insulate ourselves from worldwide financial panics created by inflation from central banks. So it doesn't make sense for us to put off that buying any longer. Just buy it and go on, you know.
Right. I had a fair amount of clients waiting to buy. You know, people who who come in ready to buy sometime in the last 3 months. And and last week, at the end of last week, I threw in the towel and said, let's proceed. You know, the chances are diminishing that we're going to get a meaningful correction, and so let's proceed. I agree with you, because the worry is not that it's, you know, things quiet down after the August 5th and it drops. The danger is it goes on to the next leg up and you miss it. And I think that's the greater risk.
Right. That's exactly right. And you're looking, you know, you have to look at the long term of this market. Let's say gold goes to $3,000. That's a double from here. That won't be much, but that's, it certainly should do that much. And if it does that, silver goes to $187.50.
Right.
At 16 to 1, assuming that's the top of the market, which it probably would not be. But and those of course, are not hard fixed targets, but they are just comparable numbers. And there's no reason to think, since gold went up nearly 25 times in the last bull market, if it goes to 16,000, it would be going up about less than 15 times. So that's not an unreasonable expectation. So,
okay, so
and besides,
go ahead.
and besides, what else are you going to do with the money? You got to put it in one of those great CDs that pays 0.5% and wait for the dollar to go down, dollar index to go down from 75 to 72 and then 70 and then 40.
At Sea Lane, we've got a fair amount of cash right now, so I don't mind having cash for a couple of other reasons. But it reminds me of when I was living in New York, and I had this big co-op off of Park Avenue, and my husband came running home, and the real estate market was skyrocketing up, and he said, "Do you know how much we could sell our apartment for? Let's sell." And I looked at him, and I said, "Where are we going to live?" It was pretty. I just wanted to bring up one subject, because this is a conversation I've had about 10 times in the last month, and and it underscores the challenge of dealing with something as volatile as silver. I've had more than one client say to me, you know, because I went to everybody and said, let's swap silver to gold. And on some folks, particularly those who had a big taxable event, we decided not to. And so I had one come back to me and say, you know, you should have forced me to do it. I'm really angry with you for not forcing me, you know, to swap out of silver and into gold because I've lost a fortune on my silver. And I said, well, that's really interesting, you know, Harry, because at the end of the year, silver was $30.70. And now it's $37. And so you've made a 20% return in 6 months on your silver. On an annualized basis, that's 40%. How is it that you've lost money on silver? And he said, well, it was 50 and now it's 37. And I said, no, you know, you have a 40% annualized return as of right now. And literally, Franklin, he had completely forgotten that. There's something in our psychology that always wants to think of it in terms of what I had at the high. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm sure you deal with that.
And opportunity, and the whole concept of opportunity cost. Opportunity cost is a theoretical construct. That's not a reality. You know.
Right.
When you have a loss is when you realize a loss. So,
right. Any more you want to say on the market and where you think it goes from here?
Well, I think that what it seems to be saying to me is it's got a considerable way to move up. I don't know if that's, you know, 1625, 1700. There's a big rest due at some point, but that point will probably be after the end of the year. This is supposed to be the slow season for both stocks and silver and gold. It hasn't been, but of course you've got a financial panic pushing that. You heard the other day that Bernanke said in his testimony 2 days ago that gold was not money.
Right, he said gold was what you wanted to hold if you were worried about the health of the system, though.
Right, well, he just said it's just a tradition. It's just a tradition. This is ridiculous. The man could have picked up Title 31 of the United States Code and read that gold is money in any number of sections that made various gold coins money. So, but this is the, you know, I'm convinced the reason Bernanke came out with those statements was they needed to crash the dollar to keep the euro up. Because if you look at the behavior of the euro is trying desperately to break down below its 200-day moving average and just sink out of sight. And we all know that central bankers work together. And there's just not much question in my mind that Bernanke's made those statements about supplementing, what was it, some kind of policy supplement or something like that, which was intended to give the idea that he meant QE3. And I'm sure he did that to knock the wind out of the dollar in favor of the euro. But those and they'll come after gold here in a day or so. I expected them to do it today. But the dollar came back again today. And so they're going to have a hard time keeping the dollar down and the reason is not because the dollar is so great, but it's a lot better than the euro at this point. And so people are fleeing for safety. The interesting thing is that they're fleeing for safety not only to gold but also to silver. Apparently,
right.
unless that was restricted to just a massive short covering rally in silver, And of course, a lot of it was driven by shortcoming. But at any rate, I'm not used to seeing in a panic seeing silver fall a gold.
One of the things we've gotten several questions on is what you expect. Curious what you expect. You know, the miners have very much lagged bullion, and what you expect from the miners coming into the if we're moving up, what happens to the miners?
When you say miners, you mean mining stocks? I'm sorry.
Mining stocks. Yeah.
I don't know. I think that the mining stocks performance has been hurt overall in the last few years by the appearance of the ETFs, because the ETFs have sucked off demand from the whole gold and silver complex.
Right.
They give, you know, clearly a mining stock is another bundle of risks on top of all the risks of the gold or silver market. It's has all the risks of an operation, an enterprise, and all the things that can go wrong in an enterprise. So they just have not shown the same type of leverage. The mining stocks have not shown the same type of leverage that we, you know, that they're supposed to give. And that points out to me again that I'm just not very enthusiastic about owning mining stocks, because I've seen studies from the last bull market that show that mining stocks do not outperform the indexes. Now, not individual stocks, but the indexes
right.
do not outperform bullion. So why would I take the extra risk if I'm not going to get a leveraged performance?
Right. The I wanted to mention that the top 10 dates is transcript is ready, and I can't even call it a transcript now because Franklin decided to rewrite it, and it's quite it's much more polished, Franklin. Thank you for doing that. And it's up at the control panel, and you can also get it at the Precious Metals Library. And I think, Franklin, you know, I've reread it now a couple times, and
mm-hmm.
it's so interesting because if you really do go back and look at history, the games that we're dealing with now have been played again and again and again. And you really get perspective when you sit and you read a description of the different sort of manipulations of gold and silver throughout American history. And I don't know, to me it just gives you a great perspective. So I know, go ahead.
No, I think that it's reasonable to say that all of American history has been a tussle between the banking interests and the rest of the country, the rest of the interests of the country. And you see that going back and forth, and that you see one party ascendant or the other. And, of course, since after the war between the states, the banking interests have been ascendant. So maybe it's time for the worm to turn.
Another report we did this week that I wanted to point out to you is we got a wonderful question several months ago from someone asking about the Swiss ETF, Zurich Canton Bank, the Canton Bank in the Zurich area, has issued two ETFs, one for, well, they have more than that, but they have one for gold and one for silver. And they're the ones I've thought of as having the finest sort of quality depository and legal relationships behind it. And of course, the issue has always been is could Americans buy it? And did you have to execute on the Swiss exchange or with U.S. brokers? And Franklin, this is a very interesting story because I decided finally to really run this down and ended up mm-hmm. getting my attorney to call Zurich and talk to the bank and read the prospectus. And we talked to lots of different brokers. And this will show you the nicety of the Swiss are so clever. ZKB is not, according to the prospectus, allowed. And this is, for those of you who haven't read it, you can link to it from the blog. And we have it. It's publicly available. And it's a nice little summary. And it will, instead of taking 100 hours to figure it all out, hopefully, or spending 100, you can do it in one. But if you read the prospectus or talk to the bank, American investors may not buy it. You know, so it's just not eligible for purchase by Americans. However, if you talk to American brokers, what you will find is you can buy it from some. Now, one of the beauties of the ZKB ETF is you can exchange, you can redeem the paper in into precious metals. Now, you wouldn't want to necessarily do that in silver because there's a VAT tax in Switzerland, but certainly your gold, you can go down and take redemption in the actual precious metals. Okay, so the U.S. brokers say as follows. Some of them will execute, and you can buy it in the secondary market and hold it in a U.S. brokerage firm. However, because it is not supposed to be owned by American investors, you can't take and redeem it. So you're depending on the secondary market in the U.S. to liquefy. And they swear that they have an understanding with the Swiss that this is all okay. The Swiss will never enforce against it. You just have to liquefy in the secondary market. It's quite elegant. It's very Swiss. So here's the deal. If you want to buy the ZKB ETFs, you can do it. You just have to find the right broker. But there are brokers who do it, so I would make sure you pick out a broker who's expert in executing with foreign stocks. And you just need to know that you need to depend on the secondary market, and you can't you're going to have to liquefy in the secondary market. You can't redeem for the actual silver and gold, or unless you sell it to a Swiss friend who will trade it back to you. Anyway, so that's the story on ZKB, and you can link to it from the blog. It's up publicly. Okay, you ready for the questions, Franklin? We got a lot of them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I know, now this one is strange. I didn't understand it, but you may. I know it is illegal to possess gold bullion in the USA, but is it also illegal to own raw gold, mined or panned in any form? Does it have to be sold to an assessor immediately after finding it? Do you understand?
No, it's not. No, it's not, and no, you don't.
That's what I thought. I couldn't.
Illegal. I don't understand how they got the idea it was illegal to own gold in the United States. It's not at all illegal. Hasn't been since, well, it really wasn't ever, but I mean, it hasn't been since 1974. And you're perfectly welcome to own raw gold. I mean, anybody, by raw gold, what you mean is something like alluvial gold, you know, which comes in little 22 or 20 carat nuggets, sometimes 24 carat nuggets.
Right. Okay. Well, I couldn't figure out where that one came from, but there it was. In last week's wrap-up, it was the second quarter wrap-up, I talked a lot about why I thought sort of the framework for the emergence of a digital currency and why I believed that essentially my nickname for the people running things, Mr. Global, that Mr. Global really didn't care if the currency was called gold or fiat, as long as it was digitized and centrally controlled. And so I got somebody writing in and saying, isn't gold money a centralized digital currency system? And my answer is absolutely it is. It is a centralized digital currency system. And couldn't something like that evolve into a global currency? Yes, except the problem with gold money is that for every person who thinks they own an ounce of gold, the ounce of gold is really there. So, in fact, that probably wouldn't work for Mr. Global. But if you look at the framework of a centralized digital currency system, yes, you know, it is. And if it were to grow, you know, enormously, could it pose the same problems as any centralized digital currency system? Yes. But I think it's really important to understand that the you shouldn't assume that the people who own gold and promote gold are the good guys, and the people who promote fiat currency are the bad guys. In fact, if you go all the way up to the top, Mr. Global is on both sides. He never brings down one system until bringing up another, and I think gold is very much an important component of the system he wants to bring up. And controlling and owning the gold is an important part, which is why, you know, while the price was being suppressed, he was making such a big to-do about accumulating it all. So I didn't know if you wanted to add anything to that, Franklin.
Well, just that there's a vast difference between a private centralized agency or company, a digital money provider, and a public one. I mean, there's a big difference between gold money and the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve. So that, you know, that's the difference. But
although they both bank at Barclays. One of the comments that I got was, we talked a lot, Franklin, about the different signs that the society is being pushed to go more and more cashless. And we got a fabulous comment that I thought was a really interesting tidbit. I was in Harvard Square at the Verizon store returning a phone I had purchased for cash the week before. This is a large, very busy store. They were unable to return cash because they did not have sufficient cash in the door. In the drawer, it was about 2:30 in the afternoon, about $145. So they could either issue me a check to arrive in 7 business days or credit the phone account. After the manager finished explaining this, the salesperson who had helped me said, "This is a recent change in policy. I don't agree with it. I think you should be able to get your cash back." All I could say is, this is what the new cashless society looks like. It's becoming a major ordeal even to get hold of cash.
Right.
Anyway, but I thought
Your listeners ought to realize that most bank branches don't carry even as much as $10,000 in cash. They don't.
Right,
Now
what we've seen is we've had reports of subscribers having at their stores having to pay large amounts of money just to get cash. So you have to pay a fee to get cash from your bank. Another very good question. Do you think the attempt to achieve one world currency by the Western banks will succeed? I'll ask you that one, Frank.
We used to have a one world currency.
Really?
It's called gold and silver.
Right.
Right? So the one world currency in itself is not bad, but there's no question that they've wanted that for a long time, and they've taken a lot, you know, since the Keynesian proposals from the 30s for what he called the bank core. They've wanted that for a long time because it would perfect their ability to control things. Whether that will succeed or not, that's another question. I mean, you can see what's happening in Europe right now, where you have 15, 17 countries who have not coordinated their fiscal policies to the monetary policy, the centralized monetary policy, and it's a train wreck. It's just a train wreck. So it would be very, very difficult to do, but certainly that's been on the high, a one world currency has been high on the list for globalists for 60, 70 years.
Right. Well, I think this is an attempt that has turned violent and is going to get increasingly violent. And I don't know which way it's going to come out. And I think my concern is not, do we end up with one world currency, but do we end up with a cashless society that depends on a digital currency? To me, that is the one that's most frightening. And we see a lot of the issues in what you and I have been discussing at the local level, you know, our fears about how states might go to gold and silver. That if you have gold and silver as a local currency or a currency within a state, but you don't have food freedom and you don't have the freedom to do those things which generate an income, you know, gold and silver could literally turn out to be a sort of a gun pointed at the average person.
Right, because suppose that they denominated your taxes in gold and silver and you don't have any, and your income is not in gold and silver. Where is it going to come from?
Right. Right. That's my fear. Okay, let me read this one. As the world is being rebalanced, I believe that a large portion of the $60 trillion in paper assets, stock, bonds, IRAs, CDs, will be running out of paper and into tangibles. Gold and silver can only go so far, and foreign bonds and equities are at risk of capital controls. Real estate is local, a necessity, benefits from inflation, has intrinsic value. Landlords in third world countries are among the wealth class. Real estate did extremely well in the 1970s inflation and will hold its values during inflationary times. We'd love to get your opinion.
Well, I don't, do you want me to comment?
Yeah.
Because I don't think that all real estate benefited in the 1970s. I mean, the problem is that when you have a severe inflation, that cuts into economic activity, and that affects things differently. So that if you had commercial real estate, for instance, that might not necessarily help you. The rise in real estate might not help you. The rise in the 1970s helped farm property, for instance, helped drive farm property to incredible levels. I was talking to someone recently in Indiana, which, as you know, is extremely productive farmland, and he was telling me it was going for $7,000 an acre. Well, that's
right.
Pretty astounding. But
right, I've seen big rises in farmland around the country. Big rise.
Try to sell a condo in Florida.
Right.
See,
it's funny because I talk to clients all over the country about real estate in their place, and in some places it's a sound way to, it's a sound thing to do. In others, it's just a horrible idea. So it's very, very quirky right now. And you really want to focus on real estate, which is easy to maintain and has a very productive purpose. And that's why I think farmland is going to be one of the best classes.
Well, that was one of the points I was going to make. The question is, how much cash flow can this piece of property generate? How much can, how fast can it amortize itself? And that's the real question. There are always buys, no matter how bad a depression is, there's always a good time to buy some things. And so you just can't make a generalization about real estate. I know that there's a cliche, not a true cliche, out there that you never lose money in real estate, referring to residential real estate. It's just not quite true.
No, it's not. Especially because the kind of residential real estate we've built has a real potential in this situation to become a huge negative cash problem. Okay. Now, I just hiss about anything that comes from King World News or Eric Sprott, but here's the question. Metals trader Andrew McGuire emphatically describes a historic game changer in the PM markets that will blindside the shorts and drive prices significantly higher in his interview with 7-Eleven, and he's talking about the Pan-Asian Gold Exchange. I would love to hear your opinion on the ramifications of this new market. And secondly, if this is as exciting as Mr. McGuire describes, what the intentions of Mr. Global could be, since Mr. Global must have played a part in this. Thank you. So Mr. Global is the tapeworm.
Well, you're talking about the Shanghai Exchange largely, or there's a new one opening in Singapore too. I don't think that will be much different. The Chinese are just as big a gamblers and speculators as anybody else in the world, and a futures market by its nature is a market that is not 100% backed. It's not intended to be 100% backed. So you never balance all of those. You never settle all of those contracts with physical. So I think that any new market that opens up adds liquidity to the world market and is good from that standpoint. But I think this thing was put forward with the idea of, aha, now those honest Chinese will come in and show these pretty New Yorkers up. And we'll have an honest game for a change. Well, I mean, anybody who thinks that never has played Mahjong, it's just not a futures market is run like a futures market. And that means that there's very little actual physical metal that changes hands, and that's the way it's supposed to be run.
Right, and if you look at the collateral fraud here versus there, it's everywhere. It's funny because again and again and again, I find myself three times a week or more saying to people, there is no way, there is no way. But the other thing is, if you look at the rebalancing, so whether it's shifting the precious metals markets and the precious metals depositories around the world instead of just, in the sort of traditional places as of 30 years ago, that's happening in every market and every industry. And it's happening, underneath a plan that was made you know, it's all part of the GATT plan, and you know, this shift is a plan, and it's subject to the same satellite systems and weaponry as all the other plans. So, you know, I said at the beginning of the year, no investment moves to places around the world where enforcement can't follow. So I don't see this as being anything other than the global shift and rebalancing that we've been talking about for years.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't buy it.
I don't see any big significance to it. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm just too dull to apprehend it. But, I it's just more liquidity, more markets, that's all, as far as I can tell.
Okay. Well, we've got many more questions, but I'll hold them off until next week, because I just want to say, stick with us, because I just want to talk a little bit about our topic, and let's go to the movies, and I do want you to get to comment on it as well, Franklin. I put up for Let's Go to the Movies a trailer for a relatively short documentary called Default, the student loan documentary, and it dovetails with our special Soleri report this week. It's a book review called The Student Loan Scam, the Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History, and How We Can Fight Back. And that's up on the blog, and the trailer's up in the Soleri Report blog post as well. And I just wanted to comment on this because I'm a person who, through the mortgage market, has seen an awful lot of really ugly, hideous, predatory lending and predatory practices. And when I say predatory practices, I don't mean just the kind you see done by a fly-by-night mortgage broker. I mean the kind you see engineered at the highest levels by people like Andrew Cuomo and, you know, presidents and secretaries of agencies. So I'm talking about systemic institutional predatory lending. And I really thought I'd seen about the worst you could see, because the housing bubble was really the fraudulent inducement of an entire country and an entire generation. And then I have just the world's most wonderful client who had children who had a significant amount of student loan debt. And so I decided to dive in and look into this and see if I couldn't come up with ways of helping, provide some better resolution to family wealth and letting kids get drained by student loans. And I had my attorney help dig in. We started to research student loans and ended up reading this book, which is why we've commented on it. And what I discovered, Franklin, is that one of the people who is right at the heart of this is an old board member of mine. Can you believe this? And I used to be on the board of Sallie Mae before the sort of the real predatory games got going. And after I left, a board member of mine at Hamilton ended up joining Sallie Mae and was part of the group that privatized Sallie Mae. And I had no idea the extent to which the provisions that apply to any kind of consumer debt were stripped off, including the ability to discharge it in bankruptcy. And we have now created, as a governmental policy, Franklin, something that will ensure that all the people, all the children of people who can't afford to spend, to send their children to college. So this is the best and brightest who normally in our history would get an education and work their way up. But this is the group of people who are not the children of aristocrats, who are not the children of Wall Street, who need to presumably borrow to get an education. And they're literally being destroyed before they come out of the gate. And it's the ugliest thing I've seen, because you're not just genociding a group of the poor, you're literally killing off the intellectual energy of the whole society for another one or two generations. You're basically, Peter Drucker once said that the GI Bill was the single highest return on investment that this country had ever made. Well, you're doing the opposite. You're basically taking a financial gun and pointing it at the brains you need to build the next two or three generations, and you're just shooting it in the head and destroying it.
Right.
And it's, as a policy matter, you know, the other thing you're doing, in addition to killing the best and the brightest of a society, you're setting the world up. You're making it sure that the children of the aristocrats can win. They won't have any real competition from people who are smarter than they are. And you're making sure that you can get a lot of people to join the military, because that's the one way they can get rid of their student loans. So as a matter of engineering social policy, it's the ugliest thing I've ever seen, and it's the most destructive thing I've ever seen, even more destructive than mortgage predatory lending. And I can assure you, just go ahead.
No, go.
I can assure you, from sort of studying how it was engineered, that this is a social policy. This is a plan. This is engineered. And these guys know exactly what they're doing.
Well, essentially, it serves these people who take out the student loans, even though they're not like the serfs of medieval times tied to the land. They are nonetheless enserfed. They're not just made indentured servants, because it takes such a long time to pay those off. You know, it's not a 7-year period you can get it paid off in. And
right.
What they've done is they basically sold forward or mortgaged all of their future labor. And they're paid
right.
for it
and
now,
so,
and they have to pay it back in the future.
Right. And so they have to, you take an entire generation of your most talented people and you make sure they'll do whatever the corporations tell them to do.
Exactly.
It wipes out the innovation and the imagination of a society. It's quite extraordinary. Anyway, so I'm going to be writing more about it, but including we had a former board member who's right in the middle of it. And, you know, and I have to tell you, Franklin, when I dove in and sort of realized that, and I was quite amazed at the whole thing, I said, you know, I've never been so glad I got kicked out of Washington. Not only am I sorry that I ever knew these people, I want nothing to do with them ever again. Anyway, so student loans, the bottom line is, if your children are considering getting a student loan, I would really, or grandchildren, or you, I would really encourage you to read the student loan scam and be very, very careful. And just be aware of the extraordinary dangers and risks involved in this, and see if you can find ways of proceeding to get an education without getting a student loan, because these are very expensive and very dangerous instruments. Okay, in closing, July 21st, Scott Tipps, president of the National Health Federation, oldest health freedom group in the country, on CODEX, a very important international system, great implications to food, health, and, as we talked last week, currency as well. And I will then be leaving California and then back to Tennessee. And so on August 4th, Sally Fallon on Nourishing Tradition. She's head of Weston Price Foundation in Washington. And they are a great way of finding people locally who you can be in cahoots with. They've got chapters all over the country, an extraordinary group of people who, in fact, Franklin, you know better than I do. And
oh,
and then on August, what?
They are fabulous people.
They are. It's fabulous.
Everybody I've ever met coming out of Weston Price was really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because, you know, people say to me, how can I meet the great people in my neighborhood? I said, find the Weston Price chapter. Okay. Then on August 11th, This is going to be the great treat of the month, Franklin. I'm going to be in Tennessee, and I'm going to be at your house to do the Precious Metals Market Report on August 11th, so you cannot leave Tennessee on that day.
I'll be there. We've even got the air conditioner turned on.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, until next week with Scott Tipps on CODEX, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.